All right, good afternoon. The Public Safety and Judiciary Conference Committee is called to order. Today is Thursday, May 8th, 2025. And today it's my turn to have the gavel. So we do have a quorum present, and it's our intent today to adopt some policy items, largely the same and similar ones between the bodies. We also intend to take some testimony that has been requested relating to some House-only provisions. And then we'll see where we go from there. All right, so members, let's just start by adopting or considering adoption for some same or similar language. Chair Novotny, do you have a motion you'd like to make?
I do, Chair Latz. I move the adoption of Article 4 House language lines 39.1 through 39.99. This requires the DOC to have a supply of Narcan in facilities, and the Senate has accepted the House language.
Well, we'll see about that when we vote, I guess. That's, let's see if there's any discussion from any members of the conference committee on Chair Novotny's motion. Everyone has done their homework, apparently, so we all feel fully informed. All right, then all those in favor of the motion to adopt Article 4 House language, lines 39.1 to 39.9, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Umover Benton, do you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 4 Senate language lines 63.6 to 66.26. This was Senate File 1905, which disallows the fluid in a water pipe from being considered when measuring the weight of a mixture of drugs.
Is there any discussion or questions relating to this proposal? I'm not seeing any. Then on Senator Umover Benton's motion to adopt Article 4 Senate language, lines 63.6 to 66.26. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Novotny, do you have a motion?
I do. I move to adopt Article 5 Senate language lines 91.17 to 92.20. Never mind, I'm moving on to the next one. Article 5, Senate language. I was on the right one, sorry. 91.17 to 92.20. This adds dementia, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injuries to missing and endangered persons. And I recommend that we take the Senate edition of autism.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions about Chair Novotny's motion? Chair Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarity, did you say the Senate language includes the autism language?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that that's
yes,
what we
Chair Novotny. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, the Senate, thank you, Chair. The Senate language includes the addition of autism.
Any further discussion or questions? Not seeing any. All those in favor of Chair Novotny's motion to adopt Article 5, Senate language 90 lines 91.17 and 92.20, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Novotny, do you have another motion?
I do, Chair Latz. I move the adoption of Article 5, Senate language lines 100.30 through 101.9. This requires concealed carry permit holders to notify their chief law enforcement agencies of name change within 30 days and recommend that we accept the Senate language.
Are there any questions or is there any discussion from members relating to this motion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Seaberg. You have a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move the adoption of Article 5, Senate language lines 103.11 to 103.13.
Can you please explain what this motion does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This motion is the Fire Code Repealer Bill, Senate File 1578, which repeals outdated fire code, outdated statutory language that has been superseded by the state fire code.
Is there any discussion or questions relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Moeller, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 6, House Language Lines 15.27 to 19.26. This is the Domestic Abuse Advocate Disclosure Bill.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions from members of the committee? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion to adopt Article 6, House Language Lines 15.27 and 19.26, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Umu-Verbatim, I'm sorry, Senator Umu-Verbatim, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 7, House Language Lines 20.21 to 21.31, 22.1 to 23.4, 23.5 to 24.5, and 24.5 to 24.8. And would just instruct nonpartisan staff to make technical adjustments. And this is the Office of Justice Programs policy language to ensure when folks decline to go after a order for protection, the victim is notified.
Are there any questions or is there any discussion relating to this motion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Clark, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Article 7, Senate Language Lines 116.14 through 117.5. This, Mr. Chair, this is an expansion of the Victim Assistance Program's definition, specifically adding children's advocacy centers to be eligible to receive a portion of fines as a victim assistance program.
Are there any questions or is there any discussion relating to this motion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Umu-Verbatim, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Move adoption of Article 7, Senate Language Lines 118.19 to 121.12. And this is the language from Senate File 1907 that was further amended in our committee. Which allows crime victims to require notification when an offender files a letter of apology.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions relating to this motion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Moeller, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I would move adoption of Article 8, House Language Lines 1.10 to 2.15. This is the DOC in collaboration with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, modernizing and revising the language of American Indian cultural programming.
Any questions or discussion on this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Scott, you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of the House language in Article 10, the Courts Policy Bill. That's what it is, the Courts Policy Bill. So I move enactment of Article 10, remove exception.
Are there any questions or discussion relating to this motion? Must be a non-controversial bill, Chair Scott. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Liebling, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 11, House Language Lines 84.18 to 86.2. And this is language that expands the protection of parent contact information in school directories. It's House File 101.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Liebling, do you have another motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 11, House Language Lines 89.17 to 89.32. And this is the OD map bill from the Office of Addiction and Recovery. And it was House File 1429. I believe the Senate had an identical bill that moved through.
Are there any questions or any discussion relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Scott, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 11, the Senate language lines 164.12 through 166.20. And what that bill does is it puts the definition in Chapter 13.43 for public official for small cities in line with the rest of cities.
And Chair Scott, this is the language out of the Senate bill. It does not include the Met Council, which is being separated for further consideration. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I believe the Met Council is here to testify, and hopefully we can adopt that as well soon.
So on Chair Scott's motion to adopt Article 11 Senate language lines 164.12 to 166.20, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 11, Senate language lines 174.1 to 174.17. This is a bill that was brought by the VCA. They post videos of officer-involved death videos, and there are a lot of videos that are produced that often aren't related to the incident itself. Those are still available to the public, but they just, under this bill, wouldn't need to be posted publicly if they don't have anything to do with the incident.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Westland, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of the Senate language in Article 12, which regards mortgage foreclosures. This includes Senate File 1962, which is a Senator Pappas bill, and essentially this applies the postponement of foreclosure sale that is allowed currently for foreclosures by advertisement to now apply also to foreclosures in action or by action.
And Chair Scott, did you wish to describe additional language?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Senate File 2338 and House File 1027, which passed as a standalone bill in the House, but is included in here in the omnibus bill. And what it does is that it addresses any excess that the county sheriffs have after a foreclosure.
Any questions or discussion relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Scott, you have a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 13, House Language Lines 21.6 through 21.20, 21.21 through 22.26, and 22.27 through 24.4. And that addresses the statewide Office of Appellate Counsel. That's House File 1862, and it's clarifying language. There was some dispute last time over whether that agency was part of the executive branch or the legislative branch. This clarifies that it's under the executive branch.
Any discussion or questions relating to this motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Umu Verbeten.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Article 13, House Language Lines 26.15 to 27.22. This comes from House File 2781, which sort of further defines custodian. It was a bill that was passed last year, and then we wanted to more narrowly define that so that only kind of the folks who have legal custody over a child would have to be notified in these instances.
Is there any discussion or are there any questions? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Westland, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt Article 13, Senate Language, lines 213.28 to 219.8, and on page R30A13, after line 219.8, insert effective date. This section is effective January 1st, 2026. This is the language related to orders for protection for vulnerable adults who may be victims of financial exploitation, and it permits a third party to intervene on their behalf.
Any questions or discussion on the motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Moeller, do you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Article 14, lines 1.24 to 4.14 and 11.25 to 13.12. This is from House File 1901. It's a school safety bill related to anonymous threat reporting systems, and it only includes the budget neutral provisions of that bill, which is namely to make sure when students get their active shooter training that they're informed of anonymous threat reporting systems, which the BCA has one already, and some schools have their own that they use. And then the schools that have active shooter threats would need to report that sort of general information to the BCA Fusion Center, and then the BCA Fusion Center would include that in their annual report.
Any questions or discussion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. So, members, we're going to turn now to some testimony to answer questions that members may have. We're going to start with House File 764. We're going to invite to the testifier table State Fire Marshal Van Creer.
Mr. Chair, can we be reminded of what line it is in the side-by-sides? Sorry, or maybe nonpartisan staff.
We can be reminded, but it will not be me doing the reminding.
Thank you.
Any staff who knows, jump right in.
I didn't mean to ask a trick question. Sorry.
Why'd you ask?
I know, and it feels like we're moving a little bit quickly through all this stuff. And just so you know, I mean, we've all had quite a bit of time to go back and look through all of the side-by-sides that we have in front of us and to think about what the proposals are, compare the language between the House and the Senate versions, and consider what to do. So what we've adopted basically are the items that are either non-controversial or the language was identical or similar with basically technical differences that staff has recommended which version of the technical language should be adopted. So that's what we've just concluded. Now there were some questions. Do we have a page and line number on the side-by-sides for this proposal?
Mr. Chair, is this the arson statute of limitations issue? Yeah. Then it's the Article 4 side-by-side beginning on the bottom right of page R33, House-only language.
Article 4, R33. Statute of limitations proposed for arson crimes to be extended from 5 years to 10 years, basically. Mr. Fire Marshal, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and maybe you can give us then an explanation of the basis for your office's request here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Dan Cryer, and I am the State Fire Marshal. I've been fortunate enough and blessed enough to be in this role now for a year and a half, and the proposal, the language before you is something that we were made aware of and then brought in as technical experts as to what the impact this might be to fire investigations in Minnesota. And now I want to bring everyone, our focus here at the State Fire Marshal Division, we may not be involved in every single fire investigation. And I think that maybe seems obvious, but I just want to make sure that it's stated. We have the onus of who performs the fire investigation rests at the local level. So it's the local fire chief, the local fire code official who has responsibility to ensure that every fire with damage of $100 or more, that would include loss of life or injury, is investigated. Most jurisdictions in Minnesota do not have a dedicated and trained qualified fire investigators, so they utilize our investigators to perform that investigation. So some of the information I give today may only give a 90% view of what's happening in Minnesota just because of our lack of involvement in every single fire. So from a perspective of going from a 5 year to a 10 year statute of limitations, I will say there are some benefits that we see from our office in the cases that we are involved with. Namely, we have currently about a handful of investigations that involve potential links to arson situations or connections that span an 8 year period. And so at the current 5 year limitation, we wouldn't be able to provide justice for those victims who maybe had their fires or had some damage or something done to them in years 6, 7, or 8. And so we see this as a benefit to being able to provide justice and to be able to get to those facts for everybody who is impacted by maybe the individual or individuals who committed that incendiary or arson fire. In today's age, a lot of what we see for our investigations is not necessarily just made at the scene. So fire, by its nature, is a destructive force. So much of the evidence we see is burn patterns on a wall. If we're lucky enough, there might be traces of an accelerant that might be added. But then what we follow is a scientific method to try to prove all of the other sources in that area that did not start the fire. And then we are looking to rule those out while also rule in that definitive what started the fire. And that process can take 1 week, 2 weeks, depends on the size of the building, the complexity of the fire. We also conduct interviews, But a lot of the evidence that can come into play for a successful arson charge and hopefully prosecution is going to be made from electronic data, things that we're all collecting and that we're all able to have today, things like Ring doorbell camera footage, other security footage, electronic records for financials, systems, you know, tracking things on any device they might be carrying with them. So it takes time to get that electronic evidence. And so that current five-year time frame, when we're wanting to make sure that people's constitutional amendments are protected on trying to get that electronic data, we're making it, it can take time. And that's purposeful, right? We don't want to infringe on anybody's rights. And so that five-year time frame for us to conduct a very thorough and comprehensive investigation, we can take up a good chunk of that time, but we're only part of the equation. We then need to get our prosecutors to understand the impact that that fire has made to, or has had on a Minnesotan. And arson is not... I won't speak like I'm a prosecutor. I've only talked to them, but arson isn't the top priority when it comes to many prosecutors. Many of them, it seems, they have a lot of priorities, a lot of competing priorities. And so sometimes that falls to the bottom of the docket, and then by the time they get to it, it takes that refresh of the memory. How do we work together to have that successful and comprehensive investigation package for charging? A lot of overview. I didn't cover quite everything here, Chair, but I'm happy to answer questions or go into more specifics as you and the other committee members would like.
Thank you, Marshal Cryer. So I do have a question. You said you've got some investigations that or incidents that span an eight-year period. Can you give me an example of something like that? I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding how an investigation could take 5 years. Or even 4 years and then a year for prosecution decision and indictment.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I talk about the eight-year time frame, that example, I maybe misspoke on it. Those are multiple fires over an eight-year time frame, and maybe the first fire, that case is closed, but in the situation I'm thinking of, an individual was not identified, but it was classified as an incendiary fire. Now, as those same patterns have emerged, there are potential suspects, and so that is the link on that specific case. As far as the time to complete a single investigation, especially one related to arson, it's the necessary time to obtain those financial records, the electronic data, the requests for subpoenas, search warrants, things to facilitate being able to get that data, digest it, and then return back to people we maybe need to interview to see how that further connects the dots. So that is usually what takes a bulk of the time of that five-year time frame.
I'm not going to ask you to reveal anything in that lengthier investigation with repeat instances that might compromise the investigation. And I guess I can understand, you know, when you start seeing patterns, and you probably would want to be able to go back to the earliest of the incidents to charge that out, even if you didn't have the ability to do it initially. That would be the reason, I guess, for a longer statute of limitations, so you could capture all of the incidents as a part of the crime. I mean, you could investigate even if you're beyond the statute of limitations, just to tie it in, and you can use prior similar incidents as a part of a more recent incident in prosecuting that more recent crime. But the statute of limitations would mean you'd have the ability to go back and charge out the oldest of them. I'm not law enforcement. I don't do these investigations. It's just harder for me to understand why it would take 4 years, even to subpoena financial records, to get them, to review them, unless these are, I don't know. I'm just, maybe others don't feel the same hesitation. The only reason I ask is because, extending a statute of limitations leaves open the possibility of charges. For for a long time. I mean, even a couple of years is a long time if you're an individual and you think someone is suspecting you, but you're not sure, and there's a cloud in the community, perhaps, maybe, maybe not. Maybe you're no longer a suspect, but no one is saying anything because they don't want to compromise an investigation, those kind of things. And it also becomes harder to defend a case that is older when it gets charged out. I mean, law enforcement may be gathering information, investigative data, and hanging on to all of it. And then all of a sudden, someone gets charged, and the defendant is starting from scratch 8 years later to try to go back to find out what they think might be exonerating information or alibi information and evidence and so on. It just makes it that much harder for a defendant to mount an adequate defense. I'm hesitant, to extend statute of limitation for those cautions. I at least wanted to have some more information from you. But I understand Chair Mueller may have a question or comment as well. Chair Mueller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just more of a comment. I mean, I certainly appreciate those concerns about that length of time. I guess I'll just say with respect to these serial fires, even if the one that happened first that's now expired could then be used to help prove a more recent one, you still don't have justice for that initial victim and restitution. I think the ability to seek restitution for that initial fire for which the time is expired is really important to me when I'm thinking through this. Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Chair Navat.
Thank you, Chair Latz. For nonpartisan staff, just to clarify for everyone if they have any concerns about that, that this is just limited to the first degree arson.
Can we ask staff perhaps to define first degree arson for us? How it's different than second degree or third degree? Mr. Johnson.
Senator Latz and members, first degree arson is 609-561. It has to do with arson of buildings. I can give you a more precise explanation in just a minute here. But arson is divided up based primarily on the type of thing that has been burned, and 609-561, which is first degree arson, deals with arson to dwellings and to buildings. Arson in the first degree has three different subdivisions. The first one deals with dwellings, and it talks about unlawfully using fire or explosives to intentionally destroy or damage a building that's used as a dwelling. And it doesn't matter whether the inhabitant is present. First degree of other buildings applies when someone who's not a participant in the crime is present in the building and the defendant knows that, and the circumstances are such as to render the presence of such a person a reasonable possibility. The third way of committing a first degree arson has to do with using a flammable material, an accelerant of some sort, to facilitate the arson. And to Representative Novotny's question, this is limited only to that first degree, so it would not apply to those other degrees of arson. The other degrees of arson tend to involve either second degree would be a building that's not covered under subdivision one, so essentially a non-dwelling that is not occupied. The other degrees have to do with other types of property that are not buildings or dwellings.
Thank you. Directed at Marshal Cryer, I apologize for not talking to you about this beforehand, but without revealing the investigations you're talking about and with some of the cases I was involved with, some of these cases, would it be fair to say, involve a lot of emotions, or there's a triggering event that leads to the actions that take place in these fires, and it might be a long time between these events that trigger the actions, is what I'm trying to say without saying anything. Would you agree or disagree? Or, like I said, these are highly emotional cases. They're the object of whatever the arsonist or the actors is. It could be as I said, a long time between whatever that trigger is. Would you agree or could you expand on that?
Marshall Cryer.
All right. Chair Latz and Chair Novotny. So, yes, any type of fire is going to bring about a lot of emotion, and it's both specifically to one that is intentionally set or an arson fire. There's going to be emotion on both sides of that equation. You're going to have the victims and the emotions that they're feeling as a result of the impact to the loss. But then there is trying to determine what is the motive, what is that, as you put it, Chair Novotny, the triggering event, that emotion that generated the motive to start that fire. It can range a lot, and I don't want to dive into each of them, and I think we could bring a psychologist in to talk more specifically about that. But it is oftentimes, in my experience, what I've seen for arson fires is it's viewed as a property crime, and it's viewed as I'm committing this act to hurt somebody because I'm damaging their property, and specifically to first-degree arson, that brings in the component that this can impact a person, an individual, or people. And so while maybe that motive may be to cause some financial hardship or to send a message, to get up to the level of first-degree arson, there has to be some potential that it could have hurt somebody, whether, you know, as the staff mentioned, based on the dwelling type that was damaged. And then to the time frame of when those triggering events happen, it can be, like with many crimes, it could be attention seeking, and maybe the person is getting their attention or they're not getting the attention, and so that changes and alters the patterns that for how they commit the arson. Again, based on my experience, many times it's sometimes it may be relatable to other crimes. I can't speak to that. It's a crime of opportunity. It's, you know, a frustration, and then this would not be a first-degree arson, but it could be, and this is part of some of that 8-year case that I talked about, it could be an empty building in an outlot of a rural area, and just there's an opportunity for me to express my frustration, and it just happens to be there at the time that I'm feeling that emotion.
Thank you, Marshall Cryer. Thank you, Chair.
How frequently, Marshall Cryer, do you have an 8-year pattern that you're investigating? It sounds like you've got a particular case in the office. You're concerned about losing the ability to charge out the earliest events. And so you've come to the legislature asking to change the law so that you'll keep that ability should you develop enough probable cause to do so. Is that what's going on here? Marshall Cryer?
Chair Latz. This was a proposal, like I mentioned, we were brought in as technical experts. This was not something that we were specifically looking to have altered with any specific instance in mind. But as we brought that technical expertise and started to have reason to look more specifically at these numbers and these data points, we were able to see that there is some benefit to our some of the cases that we have that are currently. The cases are closed, but maybe as the string and the individual has not been brought to justice yet. So I checked in preparation for today, I checked with my investigators. So I've referenced the one that is over an 8-year time frame, and then I'm aware of 3 others across the state that would be in that 5 to 10 year time window. We, of course, have many. We have others, I don't know, I won't try to quantify it, that would exceed that 10-year time frame.
Thank you. Any other members have questions for our testifier here today? Chair Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have another comment thinking about prosecution of an arson homicide that I did, and I think people may not realize with these cases, too, that someone could actually walk out of a fire, a victim, and look okay right at the immediately, but then die sometime after because of the impacts of that. And I don't know that it's 5 years, 8 years, 10 years. I don't know that it's that long, but just then it becomes a different investigation. Obviously, the arson's still ongoing, and it, you know, can shift to a homicide at that point. But I think sometimes for the full crime in that situation to play out, it can take a little longer in these cases, perhaps, than in other cases. Just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
So, Chair Mueller, I mean, I can lean on your prosecution expertise then. When it changes to a homicide investigation, if there are homicide charges, that would be subject to the homicide statute of limitations, right? Not the arson.
That's right, Mr. Chair, and there is no statute of limitation on the homicide investigation. Right.
But you could perhaps have someone exposed to chemicals released in the course of a fire, they get lung cancer, takes a while, and they can still draw a causal connection. Is that the kind of scenario you're addressing, or is there something more?
No, there's something immediate. More. It has to do with how burned your body is. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to get into the graphic details. Thank I'll just you. Leave it at that.
Chair Navani.
Thank you, Chair Latz. Marshal Cryer, what's the insurance retention time periods that you typically deal with?
Marshal Cryer.
Chair Latz and Chair Novotny. So, again, thank you for this question. So, in preparation for the testimony today, I connected with the Minnesota chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators, which is the trade group for professional organization for arson investigators here in Minnesota. It's comprised of public fire investigators and private fire investigators who are generally hired by insurance companies. Not to give us, and so different scopes of work, but overlapping work. And in talking with them about this statute, I was told that the statute, I don't know if statute is correct, but the time when insurance will retain evidence and retain the ability to file claims, specifically with arson, is 10 years. So this would, this change here would a better align that criminal aspect with what could be a civil aspect.
Last question.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you. And then one final question for you, Marshal. Is it fair to say that in a lot of cases that insurance does play a significant, if not a driving factor, in some of these significant arsons?
Marshal Cryer.
All right. Thank you, Chair. So insurance plays a role. It's a separate but parallel role. So we have an arson immunity statutes where we can share information between our groups, but they are separate investigations. So there are times where there is agreement, there are times where there are disagreement, but we have to make sure that we are both coming up to with our independent conclusions. Specifically, some benefits of a productive relationship when there is that parallel investigation is the resources that the insurance company has for equipment such as x-ray of devices. If this cell phone was believed to be the source of the fire, we're not going to take it apart. We want to try to x-ray it and see if there is a malfunction inside of this electronic device. It could also be a faster turnaround on chemical analysis. Now, we will still collect our own samples because we have our state-of-the-art laboratory with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we rely on them to perform those lab analyses. But yes, there is a productive and collaborative, there is benefit to a collaborative relationship on that separate but parallel investigations. And so it's working together, but also making sure we both come up with our independent facts and answers.
Thank you, Marshal.
Members, are there any other questions?
Thank you. All right, no further questions at this time for Marshal Cryer. Thank you, Fire Marshal, for your testimony today. Let's go on to the next testifier. We want to have some conversation about the Met Council and House File 1596. Judge Shetnin is here for the Met Council. You go ahead and identify yourself for our record, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Thank you, Chair Latz and members. My name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Metropolitan Council, and I am here to speak to the provision that was House File 1596. It was a bill carried by Representative Acomb on behalf of the Met Council. It deals with making a amendment to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, and it makes some changes to include certain members of the Metropolitan Council.
So Mr. Shetton, if you hold on just a second, we're going to get the reference to the language to our members here so we can follow it. It's in Article 11, members. R7, Article 11, R7.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it is on R7, and I believe it.
Actually, the operative language that we're talking about is on R8.
That's correct.
So if you could help tell us what the reason was for approaching the legislature with this proposal.
Absolutely, and thanks again for the opportunity to be here. We had a situation this last summer where we had a high-profile employee of the Met Council who left service, and there were a number of data practices requests related to his resignation and separation from the council. At that point, we were working with our general counsel and to be able to fulfill those, but at that point it was determined that this particular position was not subject to the data practices provision that created a public official. And so looking at that a bit further, we realized that the council chair, the council members themselves, the executive staff at the Met Council were not subject to this either. And I believe, or we believed, that that was not the intention of the law. So in order to be transparent, we brought a bill forward in order to correct that and have the Metropolitan Council and our leadership be subject to the same laws that we believe the Data Practices Act wanted to have the Met Council and our members included as public officials as well. So this is really the council asking to be included. And this bill was heard a number of times in the House. It is also being carried in the House State and Local Government Policy Bill that Representative Quam and Representative Freiberg are carrying, but we're also very happy to see it included here in the House position.
Any members of the conference committee have any questions for Mr. Shetton? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really a question, but it warms my heart that there's a unit of government that wants to be subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act and that they want to have this level of transparency. And I just commend the Met Council for bringing this bill and kind of wanting to self-govern and self-police and make it this information public. It's commendable in my mind, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other discussion or questions? Not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Shetton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your consideration. Have a great day.
Senator Umar Verbaten, I understand you'd like to talk about wage theft. And members, that's in Article 6.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This came from Senate File 1909. And we do have a representative here from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office who I think could provide some additional testimony just to help us understand how they approach these cases. And particularly some issues where there may be a person whose wages have been stolen, who's also been misclassified, and isn't currently being classified as an employee, and how they would go about getting an administrative subpoena to get access to the records to conduct the case. So if we could hear that testimony, that would be helpful.
Sure. We'll ask, is it Alex Halverson who's here? Mr. Halverson, come on forward. And can staff direct us to the page in Article 11 that this language is contained on?
Mr. Chair, it's...
Mr. Backus.
It's Article 6, page R1.
Article 6, page R1. Mr. Halverson, if you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Halverson, and I'm a senior attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office Worker Protection Unit.
Senator Moore-Verbaten, did you have anything specific you wanted Mr. Halverson to explain? Or Mr. Halverson, do you understand the senator's question?
I do. I can give a brief sort of high-level summation of our position and how the amendment would affect our work and what it does and doesn't do, or I can answer specific questions, whatever this committee prefers.
I think your brief high-level summation would be helpful.
Sure. So the subpoena bill and specifically Minnesota Statute 388.23, that's what we're talking about here. We already have some capacity for administrative subpoenas. What it doesn't apply to is the more or less recently enacted wage theft statute, which was enacted in 2019. What the proposed amendments do, they expand the scope of the existing power that's already there to touch on investigating and the ability to investigate wage theft cases. So, you know, law enforcement's still going to be involved in these cases. We're going to get referrals from them. This is just basically a way for us administratively to take some of the stuff off of their plate so that they can focus on more pressing issues on like violent crimes and things like that. We can focus on things that are more directly within our wheelhouse, such as financial crimes. These wage theft crimes would fall under that and provide our expertise in investigating these crimes. The other sort of import of it is that these requests are typically non-controversial in that we're just asking for bank records or phone records or other like payroll records, things like that, stuff that typically isn't going to create a lot of dispute. It's something that we would do and then the police wouldn't have to do on our behalf to get. So it's really just shifting the burden over to us from law enforcement so that they can focus on the violent crimes and the other more pressing issues than these.
So certainly one of the questions that came up at least in my mind, was why an administrative subpoena rather than being able to go to a court and get a search warrant? Could you help us understand why that would be valuable to you?
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Chair. So I think the import of this is that we could still go get a search warrant for some of this stuff, certainly. The point is that the administrative piece of it allows us to get what are the typically, again, non-controversial documents from third-party sources like banks and things like that that would be covered under this statute. So, you know, if the subject of the investigation has payroll through ADP or has a bank account with Wells Fargo, we can just send that subpoena to them and get it that way.
Do you have any concerns with regard to, at least early in the investigation, whether or not you would have sufficient cause to get a judge to issue a search warrant?
Not typically, Mr. Chair, no, because the way these go typically, in my understanding, and you know, I want to emphasize I'm still relatively new to the position, so I don't have a great breadth of experience exactly how these cases go, but my understanding is that we'll get a referral from a law enforcement agency, whether it's the BCA or police department, typically I think it's the BCA, and they will have already started an investigation and they'll send us a referral over and say, hey, we think, you know, there's some there, so to speak. And so that's kind of the basis for our investigation to start on our end to get some of these additional records that maybe they didn't get.
So you think you'd have sufficient information at that point? Or I guess I should ask, what do you do now?
Sure.
This information.
And in other scenarios, you know, we might not be getting a referral from say the BCA, right? We might get some information from some public citizens who are complaining about wage theft to our office. You know, one of the things we're doing is to set up a form and an intake form essentially so that the public can submit their own complaints about, you know, whether or not they believe they've been subject to wage theft, that our investigators can look into that as well. the point is, and going back to your question, is yes, if we have enough sufficient probable cause, we could go get a warrant, certainly. But I think it goes into then we're creating more work for our law enforcement partners when we could just go get it administratively ourselves and make it simpler and take the burden off of their plate.
So how are you handling it right now without the administrative subpoena authority for these investigations?
Well, right now it's on the investigators to subpoena this stuff. We don't have the authority under the statute at this moment for wage theft purposes to subpoena these records, as I understand it.
So who are the investigators with? The local law enforcement agency?
It could be local law enforcement. It could be the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Some of the cases I've seen in the past have come from, now I believe they're with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, but have been with the fraud unit, Department of Commerce, those types of agencies.
And they have administrative subpoena authority right now?
I am not sure about that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So you don't know if they're going to a judge to get search warrants or if they're using other authority?
I've seen cases. I've seen cases where they have search warrant authority. So the answer is they can do both in some instances. Is my understanding. I've seen case files where they have issued subpoenas and received bank records. I've also seen cases where they've issued asked for an issue and then served search warrants.
And if your local law enforcement agency, say the Minneapolis Police Department, is doing an investigation. What do they do under current practice for the investigation? Are they investigating these kinds of things, or are there other places, if it's not the BCA, where this is being investigated, or are they investigators with your office specifically?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my understanding is that the local police departments typically aren't investigating these cases because they don't have the bandwidth to do it. So my understanding, for example, with Minneapolis PD, and I've heard this secondhand, so I might be wrong on the exact number, but they don't have a significant amount of, say, financial crimes investigators at their disposal to dedicate to this. So that, plus the fact that they're, you know, it's been well reported that they are dealing with staffing issues over there, I think these types of cases typically go to the bottom of their priority list. Understandably, they have, you know, bigger things to worry about. So, frankly, we don't get a lot of financial crimes cases from local police departments, is my understanding.
Anyone else have any questions or comments for Mr. Halverson? Senator Uma Verbaden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you could speak to other areas where you would have the administrative subpoena authority to get financial records. Does that exist for like identity theft or welfare fraud cases, other fraud cases where you would be able to get those records?
That's right. Apologies. That's right, Senator. Yes, currently the way the statute is written, I believe there are several specific classes of cases or types of cases where we can get those records. Financial exploitation of vulnerable adults, identity theft, and there's a third one that that's escaping me right now. Welfare fraud or like public benefits fraud, basically. Those are three categories where Section 388.23 already give us that power. And with the amendment, wage theft would be included in that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would see this as like an important measure just to combat fraud. Of course, wage theft is like the crime itself is taking the wages away from workers, but oftentimes once you're digging into those cases, there could be, you know, some tax evasion, there could be other programs that folks are not paying into, defrauding the government, defrauding other taxpayers. Some of these like really serious cases might involve labor trafficking or some other violent crimes as well. So I think, you know, that could lead to defining other crimes that have taken place. So I think it's really important to get access to that. And then just to clarify, so knowing that oftentimes some of these really bad actors will intentionally misclassify a worker and will not, you know, will sort of pay them under the table or have them get paid 1099, that my understanding is that's why this was written to say that you could get records from a business entity. Would you foresee any issues, you know, if you didn't have that language of being able to get records at that time from, you know, whoever sort of holds power over that worker, if we don't have that language in the bill?
Mr. Helvers.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah, so I think one of the concerns would be that, so what you just described, misclassification of employees, right? So somebody who should be an employee, whose employer controls their sort of time and manner of work, when they appear, what's how they do their work, those people are typically or should be considered W-2 employees, right? What happens is in order to save on, say, payroll taxes or not be subject to other wage requirements, employers will misclassify their workers as independent contractors, meaning they're not W-2 employees anymore, they just get a 1099. And that also then affects the state coffers, right? Because then they don't pay in payroll taxes and things like that. So what I would be concerned about in the statutory language is that we would have the ability to still get records from people who are misclassifying their employees, even though technically under their paperwork, they may not be, you know, strictly speaking, employees as they've classified them. But if you dig down and look at the facts, they are in fact employees because they are being, the purported employer is, you know, controlling their time and manner of work and things like that we could prove.
Senator Umar-Babay.
Thank you. And then just one follow-up. So given how wage theft is written, in those instances where someone is misclassified, you know, I know that we have a number of different tests depending on, like, the industry to determine whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor. And so you can go through that process to determine, if, you know, essentially if they've been misclassified. Do you have any experience with those cases? Do you wait for, you know, someone like DLI, the Department of Labor and Industry, or DEED, which I believe also has a test? One of the tests, I think, is also through the Department of Revenue to determine that that person has been misclassified in order to keep going, or just sort of give us a little bit more information about, you know, maybe a potential case where there was misclassification, but you're still able in the end to show that this person should be an employee and that their wages were in fact stolen.
Mr. Halverson.
Sure. I think so. The process that you're kind of talking about, I think, is kind of critical to this point too, about what this statute could do for us and how at least I would like to approach it in my practice of investigating these cases, which is that, you know, let's say, for example, we get a tip from a citizen that says, hey, you know, employer A is stealing my wages or is stealing these employees' wages. Okay, we take that in. We issue maybe some administrative subpoenas to get some basic information from these sources. And then we get information that looks actionable. We can hand that off to law enforcement and say, hey, look, we think that there's something going on here. Can you, you know, work this up more formally through, you know, getting a search warrant to get more information on it? Because the test that you're talking about in terms of deciding whether or not somebody is misclassified or not as an employee or an independent contractor, that is going to be a very factually dependent investigation. You're probably going to need more than just business records there. You're going to need more than bank records, more than payroll records. You're going to need actual witness testimony from the workers themselves to come in and say, you know, my employer did, you know, told me when I had to appear, he or she controlled how I did the work and controlled all other manners of that work. And so therefore, you know, we can prove them based on those facts that that person should be considered an actual employee rather than an independent contractor. But the takeaway for me and how the investigation will go is it's a very iterative process with law enforcement. Like, we might get that, you know, tip from somebody from the public that comes in through our intake form. We do a very basic workup to get some basic information, and then we can hand that off to law enforcement or vice versa, perhaps, if law enforcement gets that tip.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a really interesting. I just wanted to make sure we had a little bit of discussion about the language online 104.16 and why the phrase or other person is in there. And I think the senator was kind of getting to some of this, but I just wanted to ask specifically. So it says, any of the following records of an employer or other person or business entity. And I just wanted to ask, you know, kind of the importance of that particular or other person phrase, who that is. I think it's relating to what you were saying about it, maybe a, maybe they're not formally an employer, and this is meant to capture somebody who may not formally be an employer, but may maybe should be an employer. Is that it, or is there any more to it than that?
Mr. Halverson.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So it would encompass what you're talking about. It might not be somebody that's formally, at least under the paper of their agreement, an employer, right? So that provision helps us cover there. It could also be, I can foresee a situation where perhaps an employer is stealing his or her employee's wages and has a, say, a bookkeeper, like a CPA firm, let's say, that is helping them cook their books. Okay, so that means then we would want that CPA's information there. They're not an employer in this situation, but they're certainly helping complete the crime, or the alleged crime anyway. And so we would want to be able to have the ability to get their records as well in that situation. That's kind of what it goes to. And then I think the third thing I would say is, you know, as I've been, I'm new to the worker protection unit, but in my previous life, I investigated, I worked for the IRS Office of Chief Counsel. I did tax litigation there, and there are innumerable ways that people will try to circumvent the law as they understand it. And so I think it's important to, like, give us, you know, within reason, broad ability to kind of, like, you know, adapt to what we're seeing out there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Lieber. So, Mr. Halverson, as I'm reading the language in the proposal here, any of the following records of an employer or other person or business entity who is the subject of a wage theft investigation, as you're describing it, a CPA or a bookkeeper, maybe the subject of the investigation, or maybe not, but still has information related to the investigation. Is that a fair distinction to make? But you'd still want that information?
I think in that situation, Mr. Chair, we would say that, you know, we would want evidence or be able to show that, that say that CPA firm, for example, right, they're helping to aid and abet the wage theft.
But then you would consider them to be subject of a wage theft investigation?
That's right.
Chair Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that the County Attorneys Association is here. That someone...
There is a representative here, Nancy Haas. Ms. Haas, do you have anything you'd like to ask? Ms. Haas, go ahead and identify yourself.
Good afternoon. Nancy Haas with Paul Haas here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I think I can just share that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office has long been a leader in this work and helped draft the first law related to this. Our criminal law committee reviewed this several times, and for those of you who know our procedure, know that that's not an easy feat. We reviewed it and went before our board, and our board does support the language. And also, there are other states that have granted this local power to local jurisdictions to do this. So we are in support of this language.
Mrs. Haas, can you describe the reasons why the language is supported, an administrative subpoena rather than utilizing the search warrant process?
Well, Mr. Chair, I could look at an email I have from our board deliberations, but I would really just be reading it, and I'd prefer maybe to get an answer to your questions and send it all to you. That would be something that would be more helpful than my off-the-cuff remarks.
Okay. Yeah, please do. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Haas at this time?
I'll go for Halverson.
For me?
Halverson. Always kidding.
Oh. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Halverson? Chair Novotny.
Mr. Halverson, thank you, Chair. In all the discussion that we've had in the time we've been talking about this, I keep hearing the words employer, employee, and business. And if someone's going to have a CPA doing their accounts, they're probably a business. If they're filing tax records, they're going to be a business. The concern that several of us have is very specific, in my opinion, and it's the other person's. And I can't think of a lot of situations that wouldn't involve, and your testimony has pointed that out, and some of the other questions we keep seeing, employer, employee, business, that keeps coming circular in the thing. And they would all be covered, and I think in the fairness that we think this is important, in the very narrow circumstances where it's other person, I don't know, you know, how often a person would not be considered covered under the other parts of the statute or the bill that, you know, they're already covered. We're down to just a couple words where it's other person. We're worried about the scope. We're worried about the expanse, and that in that situation, and then it'd have to be, like I said, very narrow that at that point, why you wouldn't just be able to go get a search warrant. Can you think of a situation that is common enough to make an exception for this opening the door to and other duties as assigned?
Mr. Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, as I sit here right now, I think I would struggle to come up with a specific example to answer your question. What I would go back to, though, is sort of my answers previously about how the other person language can be interpreted in this context and in this statute. And I'd also point out, to the extent that there's concerns about, you know, broadening the scope to just capture essentially anybody, there are already safeguards in the statute. I believe it's under subdivision C of the statute as it exists already, where it limits the records we can get to business entities, right? We can't go specifically for an individual or into their private, or issue subpoenas related to a specific individual in their private dwelling. So that would already be off limits under the statute, and that part isn't being changed here as I understand it.
C.
I'll just close with this. Thank you, Chair Latz. Mr. Halverson, you said earlier that you don't have a concern about not being able to get a search warrant in these situations that you have now. We're already suggesting, if we accept the language without the other person, that there's that would cover a vast majority of the cases that we're in, and that's just my feeling. Thank you, Chair.
Any further questions or discussion? All right, Mr. Halverson, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time and testimony today. Chair Mueller, I understand you have something you'd like to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is related to both the same and similar DOC policy and DPS policy that's in the side-by-sides. And if it's okay with the chair, I'd like to make two different motions with respect to those same and similar policy provisions. And I'll start first with the DOC policy. So I would move to adopt the same or similar DOC policy and budget neutral policy, which includes changes to the swatting statute to include all DOC employers and or employees, and the same and similar provisions in Article 8 of the Senate bill and Article 5 of the House bill. So that would be my first motion.
Right. Anyone have any questions or discussion relating to Chair Mueller's motion? Can we just get a more specific reference in our side-by-sides here so we can eyeball it? Maybe staff can point us in that direction. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Mull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the swabbing statute that I referenced is Article 4, R22. And then the other provisions are the same and similar in Article 8 and Article 5. And I can just summarize what those Article 8 and Article 5 one. It's the community supervision funding formula changes, prorating subsidy for interstate transfer unit, updates to reporting requirements, extension of the mental health unit pilot program, and the DOC's technical policy bill.
Anyone have any questions, or is there any discussion? Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to get on the record that there's no cost to extending the pilot program. It's a budget neutral.
Chair Mull.
That's correct. Chair Scott.
Thank you.
Either of our commissioners have anything they'd like to add while we're... One just walked out of the room. He must feel pretty good. We saw a tough question coming. All right, not seeing any further discussion then. All those in favor of the motion made by Chair Mohler signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'd also move to adopt the DPS budget neutral policy, and specifically the provision related to charter school fees. The language is identical in each bill.
Members want to know where the exact language is found. We have it.
Mr. Chair, it's thanks to the good work of my committee administrator here. It is R4, Article 5.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Section 11. Very bottom of the page. Any questions or discussion? Those in favor of Chair Mohler's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Anyone else have any business you'd like to bring before the conference committee today? That's all we have on the agenda. All right. Well, then, thank you for all of your work today. There being no further business to come before the conference committee on this day, we are adjourned.